The net was coarse and sharp as barbed wire, but they bent to it in a row, using the roll of the hull in the low swell to work the net in by hand, recovering a few feet with each concerted heave. Then the shoal surged again, and all the net they had won was ripped from their hands. One of the Herrero crew was too slow to let it go, and the fingers of his right hand were caught in the coarse mesh. The flesh was stripped off his fingers like a glove, leaving bare white bone and raw flesh. He screamed and clutched the maimed hand to his chest, trying to staunch the spurt of bright blood. It sprayed into his own face and ran down the sweat-polished black skin of his chest and belly and soaked into his breeches. "Manfred!" Lothar yelled. "See to him!" And he switched all his attention back to the net. The shoal was sounding, dragging one end of the cork line below the surface, and a small part of the shoal escaped over the top, spreading like dark green smoke across the bright waters. "Good riddance," Lothar muttered, but the vast bulk of the shoal was still trapped, and the cork line bobbed to the surface. Again the shoal surged downwards, and this time the heavy 50-foot trawler listed over dangerously, so that the crew clutched for handholds, their faces turning ashy grey beneath their dark skin. Across the circle of cork line, the dinghy was dragged over sharply, and it did not have the buoyancy to resist. Green water poured in over the gunwale, swamping it. "Jump!" Lothar yelled at the old man. "Get clear of the net!" They both understood the danger. The previous season, one of their crew had fallen into the net. The fish had immediately pushed against him in unison, driving him below the surface, fighting against the resistance of his body in their efforts to escape. When, hours later, they had at last recovered the corpse from the bottom of the net, they had found that the fish had been forced by their own efforts and the enormous pressures into the depths of the trapped shoal, into all the man's body openings. They had thrust down his open mouth into his belly. They had been driven like silver daggers into the eye sockets, displacing the eyeballs and entering the brain. They had even burst through the threadbare stuff of his breeches and penetrated his anus, so that his belly and bowels were stuffed with dead fish and he was bloated like a grotesque balloon. It was a sight none of them would ever forget. "Get clear of the net!" Lothar screamed again, and De Silva threw himself over the far side of the sinking dinghy, just as it was dragged beneath the surface. He splashed frantically as his heavy sea boots began to drag him under. However, Swart Hendrick was there to rescue him. He laid his trawler neatly alongside the bulging cork line, and two of his crew hauled De Silva up the side, while the others crowded the rail and, under Swart Hendrick's direction, hooked onto the far side of the net. "If only the net holds," Lothar grunted, for the two other trawlers had come up now and fastened onto the cork line. The four big boats formed a circle around the captive shoal, and working in a frenzy, the crewmen stooped over the net and started to dry up. Foot by foot, they hauled up the net, 12 men on each trawler, even Manfred taking his place at his father's shoulder. They grunted and heaved and sweated, fresh blood on their torn hands when the shoal surged, and burning agony in their backs and bellies. But slowly, an inch at a time, they subdued the huge shoal, until at last it was dried up, and the upper fish were flapping helplessly high and dry on the compacted mass of their fellows, who were drowning and dying in the crush. "Dip them out!" Lothar shouted. And on each of the trawlers, the three dip men pulled the long-handled dip nets from the racks over the top of the wheelhouses and dragged them down the deck. The dip nets were the same shape as a butterfly net, or those little hand nets with which children catch shrimps and crabs in rock pools at the seaside. The handles of these nets, however, were 30 feet long, and the net purse could scoop up a ton of living fish at a time. At 3 points around the steel ring that formed the mouth of the net were attached manila lines. These were spliced to the heavier winch line by which the dip net was lifted and lowered. The foot of the net could be opened or closed by a purse line through a set of smaller rings, exactly the same arrangement as the closure of the great main net. While the dip net was manhandled into position, Lothar and Manfred were knocking the covers off the hatch of the hold. Then they hurried to their positions. Lothar on the winch, and Manfred holding the end of the purse line of the dip net. With a squeal and clatter, Lothar winched the dip net high onto the derrick above their heads, while the three men on the long handle swung the net outboard over the trapped and struggling shoal. Manfred jerked hard on the purse line, closing the bottom of the dip net. Lothar slammed the winch gear into reverse, and with another squeal of the pulley block, the heavy head of the net dropped into the silver mash of fish. The three dip men leaned all their weight on the handle, forcing the net deeply into the living porridge of pilchards. "Coming up," Lothar yelled, and changed the winch into forward gear. The net was dragged upwards through the shoal and burst out filled with a ton of quivering, flapping pilchards. With Manfred grimly hanging onto the purse line, the full net was swung inboard over the gaping hatch of the hold. "Let go!" Lothar shouted at his son, and Manfred released the purse line. The bottom of the net opened, and a ton of pilchards showered down into the open hold. The tiny scales had been rubbed from the bodies of the fish by this rough treatment, and now they swirled down over the men on the deck like snowflakes, sparkling in the sunlight with pretty shades of pink and rose and gold. As the net emptied, Manfred jerked the purse line closed, and the dip men swung the handle outboard. The winch squealed into reverse, and the net dropped into the shoal for the whole sequence to be repeated. On each of the other three trawlers, the dip men and winch driver also were hard at work, and every few seconds another ton load of fish, sea water, and clouds of translucent scales streaming from it was swung over the waiting hatches and poured into them. It was a heart-breaking, back-straining work, monotonous and repetitive, and each time the net swung overhead, the crew were drenched with icy seawater and covered with scales. As the dip men faltered with exhaustion, the skippers changed them without breaking the rhythm of swing and lift and drop, spelling the men working onto the main net with those on the handle of the dip net, although Lothar remained at the winch, tall and alert and indefatigable, his white blonde hair thick with glittering fish scales shining in the sunlight like a beacon fire. "Silver threepennies," he grinned to himself, as the fish showered into the holds on all four of his trawlers. "Shiny threepenny bits, not fish. We will take in a deckload of tickies today." Ticky was the slang for a threepenny coin. "Deckload!" He bellowed across the diminishing circle of the main net to where Swart Hendrick worked at his own winch, stripped to the waist and glistening like polished ebony. "Deckload!" he bellowed back at Lothar, revelling in the physical effort which allowed him to flaunt his superior strength in the faces of his crew. Already the holds of the trawlers were brimming full. Each of them had over 150 tons aboard, and now they were going to deckload. Again, it was a risk. Once loaded, the boats could not be lightened again until they reached harbour and were pumped out into the factory. Deck loading would burden each hull with another 100 tons of dead weight, far over the safe limit. If the weather turned, if the wind switched into the northwest, then the giant sea that would build up rapidly would hammer the overloaded trawlers into the cold green depths. "The weather will hold," Lothar assured himself as he toiled at the winch. He was on the crest of a wave. Nothing could stop him now. He had taken one fearsome risk, and it had paid him with nearly 1,000 tons of fish. 4 deckloads of fish, worth £50 a ton in profits. £50,000 in a single throw. The greatest stroke of fortune of his life. He could have lost the net, or his boat, or his life. Instead, he had paid off his debts with one throw of the net. "By God," he whispered, as he slaved at the winch, "nothing can go wrong now. Nothing can touch me now. I'm free and clear." So, with the holds full, they began to deckload the trawlers, filling them to the tops of the gunwales with a silver swamp of fish, into which the crew sank waist deep as they dried the net and swung the long handle of the dip. Over the 4 trawlers hovered a dense white cloud of seabirds, adding their voracious squawking and squeaking to the cacophony of the winches, diving into the purse of the net to gorge themselves until they could eat no more. Could not even fly, but drifted away on the current, bloated and uncomfortable. Feathers started and throats straining to keep down the contents of their swollen crops. At the bows and stern of each trawler stood a man with a sharpened boat hook, with which he stabbed and hacked at the big sharks that thrashed at the surface in their efforts to reach the mass of trapped fish. Their razor-sharp triangular fangs could cut through even the tough mesh of the net. While the birds and sharks gorged, the hulls of the trawlers sank lower and still lower into the water, until at last, a little after the sun had nooned, even Lothar had to call enough. There was no room for another load. Each time they swung one aboard, it merely slithered over the side to feed the circling sharks. Lothar switched off the winch. There was probably another 100 tons of fish still floating in the main net, most of them drowned and crushed. "Empty the net," he ordered. "Let them go. Get the net on board." The 4 trawlers, each of them so low in the water that seawater washed in through the scuppers at each roll, and their speed reduced to an ungainly waddling motion, like a string of heavily pregnant ducks, turned towards the land in line astern, with Lothar leading them. Behind them, they left an area of almost half a square mile of the ocean, carpeted with dead fish, floating silver belly up, as thick as autumn leaves on the forest floor. On top of them drifted thousands of satiated seagulls, and beneath them the big sharks swirled and feasted still. The exhausted crews dragged themselves through the quicksands of still quivering kicking fish that glutted the deck to the forecastle companionway. Below deck, they threw themselves, still soaked with fish slime and seawater, onto their cramped bunks. In the wheelhouse, Lothar drank 2 mugs of hot coffee and then checked the chronometer above his head. 4 hours run, back to the factory, he said. Just time for our lessons. Oh, Pa, the boy pleaded, not today. Today is special. Do we have to learn today? There was no school at Walvis Bay. The nearest was the German school at Swakopmund, 30 kilometres away. Lothar had been both father and mother to the boy from the very day of his birth. He had taken him wet and bloody from the childbed. His mother had never even laid eyes upon him. That had been part of their unnatural bargain. He had reared the boy alone, unaided except for the milk that the brown Nama wet nurses had provided. They had grown so close that Lothar could not bear to be parted from him for a single day. He had even taken over his education rather than send him away. "No day is that special," he told Manfred. "Every day we learn. Muscles don't make a man strong." He tapped his head. "This is what makes a man strong. Get to the books." Manfred rolled his eyes at de Silva for sympathy, but he knew better than to argue further. "Take the wheel." Lothar handed over to an old boatman and went to sit beside his son at the small chart table. Not arithmetic. He shook his head. It's English today. I hate English, Manfred declared vehemently. I hate English, and I hate the English. Lothar nodded. Yes, he agreed, the English are our enemies. They have always been and always will be our enemies. That is why we have to arm ourselves with their weapons. That is why we learn the language. So when the time comes, we will be able to use it in the battle against them. He spoke in English for the first time that day. Manfred started to reply in Afrikaans, the South African Dutch patois that had only obtained recognition as a separate language and been adopted as an official language of the Union of South Africa in 1918, over a year before Manfred was born. Lothar held up his hand to stop him. English, he admonished. Speak English only. For an hour they worked together, reading aloud from the King James Version of the Bible and from a two-month-old copy of the Cape Towns. And then Lothar set him a page of dictation. The labour in this unfamiliar language made Manfred fidget and frown and nibble his pencil, until at last he could contain himself no longer. "Tell me about Grandpa and the oath," he wheedled his father. Lothar grinned. "You're a cunning little monkey, aren't you? Anything to get out of work." "Please, Pa." "I've told you 100 times. "Tell me again. It's a special day." Lothar glanced out of the wheelhouse window at the precious silver cargo. The boy was right. It was a very special day. Today he was free and clear of debt, after 5 long, hard years. "All right," he nodded. "I'll tell you again, but in English." And Manfred shut his exercise book with an enthusiastic snap and leaned across the table, his amber eyes glowing with anticipation. The story of the Great Rebellion had been repeated so often that Manfred had it by heart, and he corrected any discrepancy or departure from the original, or called his father back if he left out any of the details. "Well then," Lothar started, "when the treacherous English King George V declared war on Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany in 1914, your grandpa and I knew our duty. We kissed your grandmother goodbye. What colour was my grandmother's hair?" Manfred demanded. "Your grandmother was a beautiful German noblewoman, and her hair was the colour of ripe wheat in the sunlight." "Just like mine," Manfred prompted him. "Just like yours," Lothar smiled. "And Grandpa and I rode out on our war horses to join old General Maritz and his 600 heroes on the banks of the Orange River, where he was about to go out against old Slim Janny Smuts." Slim was the Afrikaans word for tricky or treacherous, and Manfred nodded avidly. "Go on, Pa, go on." When Lothar reached the description of the first battle, in which Janny Smuts's troops had smashed the rebellion with machine guns and artillery, the boy's eyes clouded with sorrow. "But you fought like demons, didn't you, Pa?" "We fought like madmen, but there were too many of them, and they were armed with great cannons and machine guns. Then your grandpa was hit in the stomach, and I put him up on my horse and carried him off the battlefield." Fat tears glistened in the boy's eyes now, as Lothar ended. "When at last he was dying, your grandfather took the old black Bible from the saddlebag on which his head was pillowed, and he made me swear an oath upon the book." "I know the oath," Manfred cut in. "Let me tell it." "What was the oath?" Lothar nodded agreement. "Grandpa said, 'Promise me, my son, with your hand upon the book, promise me that the war with the English will never end." "Yes," Lothar nodded again. "That was the oath, the solemn oath I made to my father as he lay dying." He reached out and took the boy's hand and squeezed it hard. Older Silver broke the mood. He coughed and hawked and spat through the wheelhouse window. "You should be ashamed, filling the child's head with hatred and death," he said. And Lothar stood up abruptly. "Guard your mouth, old man," he warned. "This is no business of yours." "Thank the Holy Virgin," Da Silva grumbled, "for that is devil's business indeed." Lothar scowled and turned away from him. "Manfred, that's enough for today. Put the books away." He swung out of the wheelhouse and scrambled up onto the roof. As he settled comfortably against the combing, he took a long black cheroot from his top pocket and bit off the tip. He spat the stub overside and patted his pockets for the matches. The boy stuck his head over the edge of the combing, hesitated shyly, and when his father did not send him away — sometimes he was moody and withdrawn and wanted to be alone — Manfred crept up and sat beside him. Lothar cupped his hands around the flare of the match and sucked the cheroot smoke down deeply into his lungs, and then he held up the match and let the wind extinguish it. He flicked it overboard and let his arm fall casually over his son's shoulders. The boy shivered with delight. Physical display of affection from his father was so rare, and he pressed closer to him and sat still as he could, barely breathing, so as not to disturb or spoil the moment. The little fleet ran in towards the land and turned the sharp northern horn of the bay. The seabirds were returning with them, squadrons of yellow-throated gannets in long, regular lines skimming low over the cloudy green waters, and the lowering sun gilded them and burned upon the tall bronze dunes that rose like a mountain range behind the tiny, insignificant cluster of buildings that stood at the edge of the bay. "I hope Willem has had enough sense to fire up the boilers," Lothar murmured. "We have enough work here to keep the factory busy all night and all tomorrow." "We'll never be able to can all this fish," the boy whispered.
"No. We will have to turn most of it to fish oil and fish meal."
Lothar broke off and stared across the bay. Manfred felt his body stiffen, and then, to the boy's dismay, he lifted his arm off his son's shoulders and shaded his eyes.
"The bloody fool," he growled.
With his hunter's vision, he had picked out the distant stack of the factory boiler house. It was smokeless.
"What the hell is he playing at?"
Lothar leapt to his feet and balanced easily against the trawler's motion.
"He has let the boilers go cold. It will take 5 or 6 hours to refire them, and our fish will begin to spoil. Damn him! Damn him to hell!"
Raging still, Lothar dropped down to the wheelhouse. As he yanked the foghorn to alert the factory, he snapped,
"With the money from the fish, I'm going to buy one of Marconi's newfangled shortwave radio machines, so we can talk to the factory while we're at sea. Then this sort of thing won't happen."
He broke off again and stared.
"What the hell is going on?"
He snatched the binoculars from the bin next to the control panel and focused them. They were close enough now to see the small crowd at the main doors of the factory. The cutters and packers in their rubber aprons and boots. They should have been at their places in the factory.
"There is Willem."
The factory manager was standing on the end of the long wooden unloading jetty that thrust out into the still waters of the bay on its heavy teak pilings.
"What the hell is he playing at? The boiler's cold and everybody hanging about outside?"
There were two strangers with Willem, standing one on each side of him. They were dressed in dark civilian suits, and they had that self-important, puffed-up look of petty officialdom that Lothar knew and dreaded.
"Tax collectors, or other civil servants," Lothar whispered, and his anger cooled and was replaced with unease. No minion of the government had ever brought him good news. "Trouble," he guessed. "Just now, when I have 1,000 tons of fish to cook and can." Then he noticed the motor cars. They had been screened by the factory building until Da Silva made the turn into the main channel that would bring the trawler up to the offloading jetty. There were 2 cars. One was a battered old T-model Ford, but the other, even though covered with a pale coating of fine desert dust, was a much grander machine. And Lothar felt his heart trip and his breathing alter. There could not be 2 similar vehicles in the whole of Africa. It was an elephantine Daimler, painted daffodil yellow. The last time he had seen it, it had been parked outside the offices of the Courtney Mining and Finance Company in the main street of Windhoek. Lothar had been on his way to discuss an extension of his loans from the company. He had stood on the opposite side of the wide, dusty, unpaved street and watched as she came down the broad marble steps, flanked by 2 of her obsequious employees in dark suits and high celluloid collars. One of them had opened the door of the magnificent yellow machine for her and bowed her into the driver's seat, while the other had run to take the crank handle. Scorning a chauffeur, she had driven off herself, not even glancing in Lothar's direction, and left him pale and trembling with the conflicting emotions that the mere sight of her had evoked. That had been almost a year before. Now he roused himself as Da Silva laid the heavily burdened trawler alongside the jetty. They were so low in the water that Manfred had to toss the bow mooring line up to one of the men on the jetty above him.
"Lothar, these men, they want to speak to you,"
Willem called down. He was sweating nervously as he jerked a thumb at the man who flanked him.
"Are you Mr. Lothar de la Rey?" the smaller of the 2 strangers demanded,
pushing his dusty fedora hat onto the back of his head and mopping the pale line of skin that was exposed beneath the brim.
"That's right," Lothar glared up at him with his clenched fist upon his hips. "And who the hell are you?"
"Are you the owner of the Southwest African Canning and Fishing Company?"
"Yeah,"
Lothar answered him in Afrikaans.
"I am the owner, and what of it?" "I am the sheriff of the court in Windhoek, and I have here a writ of attachment over all the assets of the company."
The sheriff brandished the document he held.
"They've closed the factory,"
Willem called down to Lothar miserably, his moustaches quivering.
"They made me draw the fires on my boilers."
"You can't do that,"
Lothar snarled, and his eyes slitted yellow and fierce as those of an angry leopard.
"I've got 1,000 tons of fish to process." "Are these the 4 trawlers registered in the company's name?"
the sheriff went on, unperturbed by the outburst. But he unbuttoned his dark jacket and pulled it back as he placed both hands on his hips. A heavy Webley service revolver hung on a leather holster from his belt. He turned his head to watch the other trawlers mooring at their berths on each side of the jetty. Then, without waiting for Lothar to answer, he went on placidly,
"My assistant will place the court seals on them and on their cargoes. I must warn you that it will be a criminal offence to remove either the boats or their cargoes."
"You can't do this to me!"
Lothar swarmed up the ladder onto the jetty. His tone was no longer belligerent.
"I have to get my fish processed, don't you understand? They'll be stinking to the heavens by tomorrow morning."
"They are not your fish." The sheriff shook his head. "They belong to the Courtney Mining and Finance Company." He gestured to his assistant impatiently.
"Get on with it, man."
and he began to turn away.
"She's here,"
Lothar called after him, and the sheriff turned back to face him again.
"She's here," Lothar repeated. "That's her car. She has come herself, hasn't she?"
The sheriff dropped his eyes and shrugged, but Willem gobbled a reply.
"Yes, she's here. She's waiting in my office."
Lothar turned away from the group and strode down the jetty, his heavy oilskin breeches rustling and his fists still bunched as though he were going into a fight. The agitated crowd of factory hands were waiting for him at the head of the jetty.
"What is happening, Baas?" they pleaded. "They won't let us work. What must we do, Baas?"
"Wait," Lothar ordered them brusquely. "I will fix this."
"When will we get our pay, Baas? We've got children."
"You'll be paid," Lothar snapped. "I promise you that."
It was a promise he could not keep, not until he had sold his fish. And he pushed his way through them and strode around the corner of the factory towards the manager's office. The Daimler was parked outside the door, and a boy leaned against the front mudguard of the big yellow machine. It was obvious that he was disgruntled and bored. He was perhaps a year older than Manfred, but an inch or so shorter, and his body was slimmer and neater. He wore a white shirt that had wilted a little in the heat, and his fashionable Oxford bags of grey flannel were dusty and too modish for a boy of his age. But there was an unstudied grace about him, and he was beautiful as a girl, with flawless skin and dark indigo eyes. Lothar came up short at the sight of him, and before he could stop himself, he said, "Schasser!" The boy straightened up quickly and flicked the lock of dark hair off his forehead.
"How do you know my name?"
he asked, and despite his tone, the dark blue eyes sparkled with interest as he studied Lothar with a level almost adult self-assurance.